From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Philippe Gelly, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro, and Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. Our moderator is CBS Radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. U.S. President Donald Trump made an extraordinary statement supporting Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and refuting his own intelligence agencies, who confirmed that the Saudi leader had, in fact, ordered the murder of a prominent journalist. The counting of ballots in U.S. midterm elections continued, with hotly contested elections in Florida and Georgia finally reaching a verdict. But accusations of wrongdoing left anger and doubt on both the winning and losing sides. Prime Minister Theresa May moved the Brexit process forward, finalizing draft agreements that will be sent to European member states for approval. And we examine a number of political moves made by President Trump that left many wondering if he misunderstands the powers of his office or if he is intentionally misusing them. So let's start, panelists, with our discussion of Jamal Khashoggi and the president's statement about that. I just want to read the first words in the official statement were, "America first," and this is on the White House website, "America first and the world is a dangerous place." And with that, the president proceeded to declare his continued support for Saudi leader, and we're going to abbreviate MBS, if no one minds, basically saying that while the crime did happen, we don't know for sure who did it, but no matter whether we did or not, low oil prices and weapon sales were more important than the assassination of a political enemy. I'm going to start with you, Linda. Mm-hmm. There's so many things to parse out here, but have you ever seen a statement like this by a U.S. president in defense of a foreign act such as this?
Well, I've never seen a statement by an American president on anything like that statement that he put out about Saudi Arabia and the killing of Khashoggi. It was full of exclamation points, which is it's President Trump's style. And I'm told that he actually, his original draft of that statement had 8 exclamation points in it. It read like an extended Donald Trump tweet. Far more importantly, he has yet again essentially renounced the findings of his own intelligence community, which is just stunning. I mean, he could, in fact, acknowledge that Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS, had ordered the killing of Mr. Khashoggi and then put sanctions in place, put sanctions that are going short of canceling these business deals that Donald Trump cares so deeply about. But instead, he is essentially throwing out the work of his own intelligence community and sending a signal to the rest of the world that he is not going to hold anybody accountable for an atrocity like this. This proves yet again that Donald Trump has a transactional view of foreign policy and that human rights are really not on his radar when considering his relations with foreign countries.
And Philippe, we talk about America first from the world's perspective. This America first, does it now mean that America first means money before justice?
Yes, probably. The president behaves like more like an accountant than a leader with a strategic view. What he's saying, as you mentioned, is it doesn't matter. Of course, high confidence in the on the part of the CIA. It reminds us in the rest of the world of the high confidence about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So you never can actually prove unless you have a tape of MBS ordering the murder. The thing is, Donald Trump is using this inevitable level of uncertainty to lay bare the fact that he has no interest in defending moral values or international norms. And what we have to wonder, he does so also by blaming the rest of the world. When on Thursday, on Thanksgiving, when he was asked who is to be taken accountable of this, he said the whole world.
The world. It's a dangerous place.
So it means not only does he bully his allies and allied democracies and put them on the same level as this kind of people ordering extrajudicial killings, as Putin did and as Kim Jong-un did. I mean, this is the kind of stuff we are dealing with. But if the United States doesn't stand up for those values and international norm, who will? That is the question now.
There's been pushback, Linda, from almost every quarter, domestic and international. I think kind of notably by guys like Senator Lindsey Graham. Mm-hmm. What can be done with the president being, with the president defending the Saudi regime? You have Republicans who want to actually do something about this.
Right. No, this presents an interesting challenge for the Congress. So we're heading into a new Congress come January with Democrats now in charge of the House. So Donald Trump is losing power on Capitol Hill. But he will face pushback from some Republicans. But that little caucus of Republicans with some power in Washington to counter the president is shrinking. So some of the most vocal opponents of President Trump have either left the stage, such as John McCain, who passed away, or Bob Corker for a few more weeks, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He's retiring. He is ending on a very vocally anti-Trump note. You have Lindsey Graham, as you mentioned, senator from South Carolina, who is criticizing Trump about his approach to Saudi Arabia, but he's one of Donald Trump's best friends in the Senate.
Very staunch supporter in the last
few
months.
Very staunch supporter. You have Senator Rand Paul also pushing back against Donald Trump on the Saudi situation. But again, Rand Paul is often with the president. And so the willingness in Congress to push back is shrinking. Now, you can draw some parallels on the Russian situation, where they have shown almost unanimous willingness to push back against the president and put sanctions on Russia. Will they follow the same posture on Saudi Arabia? I don't know.
You can argue that this is a very poor choice of a partner in the Middle East. I mean, the Crown Prince is the man who decided to launch this war in Yemen, which is a military fiasco and a humanitarian disaster. He was the one who ordered the blockade of Qatar. Mm-hmm. He was the one who ordered the temporary kidnapping of the Lebanese Prime Minister Hariri. And now this killing of Jamal Khashoggi.
So I want to throw a question as you make
with
these
friends
points.
Like that, you don't need enemies.
Can MBS survive this? Is he in trouble now in that leadership position?
He was in trouble. I think he's in a better shape to survive it now because his father, the king, King Salman, doesn't want to hear any. I mean, they have drawn a red line about, you know, putting his standing into question. It appears that the younger brother, Khaled, who used to be the ambassador of the kingdom in Washington, will take over on the international front, more in charge of the foreign policy and so on. But the Crown Prince remains in charge of domestic reforms and jobs and the economy. And they think they can weather this storm.
Last word for you, Linda. I know the president isn't the type of person or hasn't shown himself to be the type of person that voices regret for anything. But going out on your crystal ball, do you think that this administration will regret this move at some point?
Well, I think it remains to be seen. There's an important story in the New York Times about how the Saudis are, what's really going on beneath the MBS situation is the Saudi Arabia's interest in developing nuclear capabilities. And if at the end of the day, Saudi Arabia becomes a nuclear weapons power, then we may come to regret that. We could see a real expansion of nuclear capabilities across the Middle East and even the potential for war. So I think, it remains to be seen.
It certainly was something that sent ripples across the entire international community and the domestic community. So we'll certainly keep an eye on this. Let's move on to the elections in Florida and Georgia. There were close elections in Georgia for governor. And in Florida, it was governor and Senate, all ended in victories for the Republican candidates, I believe. Mm-hmm. But doubts linger over whether the winners can really bring their constituencies together because of the way that the elections were held, the closeness of them contested and so forth. Let's just go quickly over the elections. I'm going to start with you again, Lynn.
Sure.
The Florida Senate, Rick Scott over Bill mm-hmm. Nelson. You had in governor Ron DeSantis over Andrew Gillum, Brian Kemp over Stacey Adams, Georgia mm-hmm. governor. What do these elections have in common? And I think you know what
right.
it is.
Sure, sure. So in both, you had the possibility of an African-American winning in statewide office. In Florida, it was, you would have had your first black governor, and same in Georgia, first black governor. That would have been quite significant, as these are both southern states. Florida is an interesting combination, but it is has a lot of southern elements, especially in the northern parts. And so these were both messy elections, each for their own reason. There is some feeling among some people that, especially in Georgia, I think that voter suppression contributed to the victory of the white Republican. But I think at this point, everybody's ready to move on. And I think both sides can take some lessons, particularly in how their elections are run. So I see this going actually into the state legislatures to address these problems in both states and how they conduct their elections.
Philippe, I've heard it said by people who know that these elections, the governor's elections in Georgia, had they been held in another country, international election monitors would have stopped it and started it all over again because of the way that they were run. Do we have a problem with how U.S. elections are run?
Yeah, I mean, those two cases of Georgia and Florida show that it's pretty messy. It's pretty outdated in terms of the process. The fact that in Georgia, the Secretary of State, now governor-elect, Brian Kemp, kept his job supervising the electoral process during the election and the recount, suppressed 670,000 voters from the rolls. I mean, this is pretty unbelievable, right?
Yes, when you look at it, you wouldn't expect it of a U.S.
And
election.
And when Stacey Abrams, the Democratic candidate, conceded her defeat, she at the same time announced that she would throw a lawsuit against the way it was administered. Mm-hmm. And the same in Florida. I mean, you had two recounts. You had 2,000 ballots lost in Broward County. You had a resignation of a supervisor. I mean, it seems that since 2000, and I remember being sent by my newspaper to Florida to cover the chats and the dimples. And, and that was quite some fun at the time, but it hasn't really improved since then. It's pretty unbelievable.
I'm going to give you the last word on this one, too. Is the real problem the demonization of the other side? Don't both sides really lose in this situation?
Absolutely. And I think what really is lost is voter confidence in the outcome of an election. Faith in the outcome is the absolute bedrock of democracy. And when you have two important states, two battleground states, where voters may be left wondering, did the right candidate actually win? Then that's a huge problem. The ball is really in the court of the state legislatures to get at this very fundamental conducting of democratic processes.
Which is the fundamental democratic process, voting. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back with more Issues in the News.
Here's a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. You can find our other programs there as well, Encounter and Press Conference USA. Also, check us out on Facebook, and while you're there, leave a comment or two and like us. Current Affairs with Carol Castillo. Now back to our panel. Philippe Jalli, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro, and Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. Our moderator is Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor.
Welcome back. Let's talk about the ongoing adventure of Brexit, a new draft political declaration and withdrawal agreement, two separate documents, one of them non-binding, the political declaration, and one of them legally binding, the withdrawal agreement, have been agreed by the May government and have been passed forward to Brussels for agreement by the member states. Philippe, the two agreements that you have there, what's basically in those agreements? Has it made the possibility of a smooth Brexit any more possible?
It has, in the sense that it is a compromise agreement. The problem, I think, with it is more political on the British side, because it contradicts a lot of Theresa May's promises. She spent more than 2 years saying that it was better no deal than a bad deal. And now, at the time when you have to jump from the cliff, she's kind of withdrawing from these statements. And she ran this deal. Negates three promises that she had made One was getting out of the common market, getting out of the customs union, and being withdrawn from no longer subject to the European Court of Justice. And until there is a trade agreement, bilateral trade agreement between the EU and the UK, hopefully by 2020, but maybe later than that, nothing really changes so far. And the reason is, of course, this tricky question of the border with between Ireland and Ulster. And they decided that the whole of England would be still part of this temporary situation where basically you stay in the common market and you stay in the common union customs.
The agreements that are passed forward, even if they are agreed to by Europe, they still have to pass Parliament.
Right.
And they are, both agreements seem to be extraordinarily unpopular with both sides. What are the chances of any of this going forward?
So I know way less about this than Philippe, and probably you, because I'm so focused on American politics. But my view as a general observer of world affairs is that this is going to have a very, very difficult chance of getting through Parliament. As we've seen with the actions of people like Boris Johnson, the people who are eager to leave versus the people who are eager to stay, that she's being pulled in two very strong opposite directions. And it's just hard to see any chance of people coming together and agreeing on this. But Philippe, correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're right. I think the vote is scheduled for next month. You have to acknowledge that Mrs. May has been pretty tough and she has taken a lot.
She's been put in a no-win situation,
right,
practically, because the whole idea of a painless Brexit was always a fantasy, that Britain was going to get, the UK was going to get everything that they wanted to be able to exit the European Union and keep all of the border agreements they want, keep all of the trade agreements that they want. This was always a fantasy, but this was promised in the original, referendum.
I think, as we say in French, the butter and the money from the butter were promised to the people, I mean, at the same time. And so you cannot deliver.
I'm sure that sounds even better in French.
Absolutely. You want me to do it? Le beurre et l'argent du beurre.
Ah.
Lovely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're right, she's in lose-lose situation, but on the other hand, she's very strong. I mean, and the more she fights, the stronger she gets. As you mentioned, there are political opponents. They are not offering really real alternatives to this agreement and this compromise, but they are waiting for her to fall. And she might very well, if she loses this vote next month, what will happen? We have to renegotiate from the start. Mm-hmm. And then we go for a hard Brexit at the end of March 2019. And that may be much more painful.
Which makes the UK, as I've heard from some folks, almost quote unquote uninvestable, you know, as a country because of everything they have there. So in the UK, we have quite a Shakespearean situation.
And here's what I want to know. I mean, there are people who want to have a do-over on the Brexit vote. Is there any possibility that could happen?
There is still debate for a new referendum.
For a new referendum.
Yeah, it's not dead.
Okay.
But I don't see that as a very practical solution at this point.
Nor do I. Let's move on very quickly, because I wanted to get to this. We had several positions and moves that have been made by the Trump administration that sort of give you a view into how they view government in general. So before the midterm elections, you had President Trump sending thousands of U.S. troops to the southern border with Mexico. Issued a proclamation attempting to block asylum seekers that was blocked by a federal judge, a federal court. This also revealed that he had wanted to, and still allegedly continues to want to, the Justice Department to prosecute political enemies such as James Comey and Hillary Clinton. Finally, he chose his acting attorney general, a man whose primary qualification is his shared disdain for the Mueller investigation. I'm going to throw this out to you. It's right in your wheelhouse. My question is President Trump misunderstanding the law, or is he deliberately misusing the powers of his office?
So I don't think Donald Trump really attempts to understand what he is supposed to do and what his powers are as president. No matter how much he's told that this is by people who are even cabinet secretaries or in high-level positions in government, they say they work for the U.S. for the American people, not for President Trump personally. But Donald Trump persists in seeing, quote, his government as his.
As an extension of the Trump Organization.
Exactly. Almost. That he's as if he's still running a business with him as CEO. And that, of course, is not how it works. And so he has people in his midst who are still telling him, no, you can't do that. Don McGahn, who was the White House counsel, not counsel to President Trump, but White House counsel, until recently, he told him, no, you can't do that. We don't have a White House counsel right now. We have somebody who's acting, Emmett Flood, who's a serious lawyer. You know, as I say, he can try these things, and he can issue executive orders, take executive action, and throw it all into court. And then our legal system, I think, would kick in the very important check that it's there for. But it puts us all through kind of these gyrations of a president who operates outside the norms and practices of the American presidency and forces us, frankly, to go to our civics lessons. If the president himself is not doing that, at least we, the rest of the American people, are, I think, in a lot of cases.
And I think it's very well said. Philippe, one thing that I did leave out was this unprecedented exchange between the President of the United States and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts, where right. President Trump had sort of maligned the Ninth Circuit Court, a federal appeals court, and said that they were Obama judges. And the Chief Justice pushed back and said, we do not have Obama judges. We don't have Bush judges. We have American judges.
Well, you know, one of the strengths of Donald Trump is to say things, to call things as he sees them, and very often as they are. Is it really a fight you can win that to pretend that there are no Obama judges and no Trump judges? I mean, Donald Trump himself is working very meticulously to appoint a lot of Trump judges. Mm-hmm. 154 so far, 50% more than Barack Obama at this time in his presidency. So in this kind of debate, I'm not sure the Chief Justice can win, right, because it goes on the public stage, the political stage, and that's not his best ground. But as you mentioned, I draw two lessons from this. One is that he plainly sees the judiciary and the military as tools to assert his power. And he doesn't care if it is legal or not legal. It's a fight, I think, for Donald Trump. And the second, even more worrying, I think, is that he actually believes in the fantasies he's promoting. I mean, those criminals at the border, he just gave the authorization to use lethal force at the border to the military, right, who are not supposed to do any military work, only logistical work at the border to help the border patrol. He's asking the Department of Justice to prosecute or investigate on the basis of conspiracy theories about Clinton, about Comey, James Comey, the former FBI. I mean, what's next? Now you have an acting attorney general who believes exactly what the president does.
And so now the Mueller investigation is in danger. And I just want to throw, because we just have about a minute,
sure,
here, I want to throw to Linda. What does all this mean if we take all these things as a stepping stone and try to draw these points and turn them into a straight line towards the Mueller investigation, which is just about a minute? What does this mean? Is that investigation in danger, in your opinion?
So I actually don't think it's in danger. I mean, yes, Donald Trump now has an acting attorney general who is as antagonistic toward this investigation as he, Donald Trump, is. But Matt Whitaker is not a stupid man. If he were to really take serious action to constrain or try to eliminate the Mueller investigation, I think the backlash would be like nothing we have seen yet in the nearly 2 years of Trump presidency. So there's a lot of, I think, horribilizing going on here, where you can sort of play out scenarios that really create a major constitutional crisis in this country. But We do have checks and balances, and we do have, I think, human beings at the heart of this who maybe don't want to be demonized in that way. So even if Donald Trump stands astride the American government and doesn't care what people think of him, or even if the courts go after him, I think the people around him probably don't want to go there. So the Mueller investigation, by many appearances, is almost over. And so if Donald Trump is innocent, as he says he is, then he really should just let it play out.
And we're going to have to let that play out. That's all the time that we have for this week. Thanks so much to Philip Gilly, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro, and Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Joe Gill. And I'm Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor. Thanks for listening.